Well, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241, and it is March 18th. So let's look at the schedule first. What are we going to do today? What are we doing today? Anybody know what we're doing today? Somebody's got to tell me what I'm doing today. What are we doing today? Well, we're finishing up nervous system chapter number 7. All right, and today is kind of noteworthy because it is exactly 1 week before your next test. Right, so your next test is on the 25th, today's the 18th, yeah, exactly 1 week. What chapters are on that test? 4, 5, and 7. 4, 5, and 7. 7's a long chapter, so I don't feel bad about only putting 3 on there for you. All right, so we're going to finish up 7. If I don't finish up 7 today, then I'm going to do a video lecture and put it in Blackboard so that we don't get behind in the class. There's also another Thursday that I'll be gone, and I'll put a video lecture on Blackboard for that day. I'll tell you what day it is, and it's in April sometime. So, that's what I wanted to show you. So, in Blackboard, make sure that you can view the videos that I have in there right now. Right, so get that kink worked out. The video that I have in there right now is just a backup for a lecture that you already have, but you will have videos for lectures that you won't hear me do live in class. So get the technology working for yourself. All right, I'm going to pull up Blackboard while we get some news from SI. Do we have any news from SI?
Yes.
Okay. Okay, let me read that on the board so it can get recorded. So, SI, Bio 241, this week, Thursday, 3:20 at the regular location and time? Okay, and then Friday, this is a special session, 3:21 on Friday from 11:30 till 1 o'clock, and we think it's in Business 319? It's in Business 319. And then next week, no session on Thursday, but a regular session on Tuesday. That's it. Okay, so if you didn't jot that down, you can listen to the voice once again. Okay, so I promised you I'd show you where you would find some videos, even for this test coming up. I don't know if anybody looked at them yet, but here's the announcement page. This is the index page when you log into Blackboard. This is where you should go automatically, and the videos are under course documents. All right, so click course documents, and then I think you have to scroll because we got all these other things for you to look at here, study questions, periodic table, glycolysis video, all right, and you can see it's a WMV file, aerobic respiration file, that's a WMV file, so make sure that you can download those and play those in your Windows Media Player because sooner or later you're only going to get information via video format because we'll be missing a day in class. All right, so if you have a Macintosh, you will have difficulties playing WMV files unless you get a VLC player. All right, and do I have this as a link? Oh, I have that as a link to go and get it from CNET. CNET is usually a pretty reliable source. It doesn't load a bunch of spyware on your computer, but any source that you like probably would be good. DVX player would probably work as well, but VLC is a little bit more modern even than that one. Any questions on that? No, you're good. Okay. So those are the videos. Cellular respiration overview. Can't even remember what that is, but it's a Word file. I got to look in there sometime. Anybody look and see what's in there? Yeah? Find it useful? Yeah. Question?
What tab is that under?
It is under documents, course documents. Let's go back.
Thank you.
Okay, course documents. And yeah, course documents right here in the left-hand frame. Yep. And then you have to scroll all the way down to the bottom of the page. Question? Yeah? Oh, okay. They're all available. And download them to your, maybe I could show you after class, download them to your hard disk. Right click, save file as, save link as, something like that. And then you might have it, you maybe can rename it, maybe not, but just save it someplace. Maybe just your desktop. Okay? And then right click on it and select a media player that you know that works. If you have a Macintosh, you need a VLC. But it should play in a Windows media player as well. I like to use RealPlayer. Those are kind of fancy these days. You have to get involved with their cloud services as well. So I don't know if I could recommend that or not. Yeah? Yep, they are. Yep, they're there. If we finish lecture quick, remind me and I'll go take a look. I'll show you guys. All right, but where would it be? I don't know. There's a link somewhere to it. But if you, okay, where would you go? You'd go to what? Dr minus J minus Gober, control enter, and then lecture. What are you guys laughing at? Was there an animation there or what? Oh, the picture of me. You see what you guys do to me? All right, so I just clicked on Spring, right? I just clicked on Spring. Did you see that? Yeah. Okay, so here are all the lectures. They're all active links. The last one is what? Neurophysiology 2. And I'm going to put Neurophysiology 3 up sometime this week. I know you have a test, so I'll try to put it on there sooner rather than later. Yeah, so they're all there. And then you could bookmark this this page, and then you don't have to look at that picture again. Okay. All right. So we better go on to lecture right now. Does anybody have any questions? Any questions on what we covered last time? We're covering a lot of stuff. All right. So it would be really good if your mind is in tune with the stuff we're talking about before you come to lecture. Right, so if your mind has to get reset while I'm lecturing, then you're going to be missing out on a lot of stuff, right? All right, so what was one important thing? Oh, here's a good question, yeah. Sensory protein? Yeah, I don't understand the question. Okay. Yeah, I don't have that picture handy. If I show that picture, say, raise your hand. Okay, is it one I already showed or one that I will show today? I already did. Maybe I'll try to go back. How far back do I have to go to get to it? Here? Oh, look at the screen. Yeah, look at the screen. And I'll flip through. All right, so here's where I want to kind of start once again. Is it like... Here?
No.
Back more? Here?
The before.
Ah, here.
No.
Oh, okay. We'll have to find it sometime. Oh. This one?
No.
Okay. Yeah, well, I really can't see those color things. Okay. So let's talk about this. Maybe it will answer your question. Okay? If not, after class. All right, so here we have a particular receptor, all right, and a receptor has to bind a ligand. In this particular case, what can you tell me about the ligand as I get the PowerPoint presentation working good? What can you tell me about the ligand on this particular picture? Okay, it is acetylcholine. You know acetylcholine to be a neurotransmitter. It's one of a bunch of neurotransmitters that we're going to look at. And anything that uses acetylcholine as a neurotransmitter, or if there's a receptor for it, we call that a cholinergic system. So here is a cholinergic receptor because what does it bind? Who can tell me? What does it bind? It binds acetylcholine. All right? So here is one particular kind. There are a number of different kinds of cholinergic receptors. And this is an example in particular of a nicotinic acetylcholine receptor or a nicotinic choline receptor. How many ligands does it bind? I see two. When both of these sites are bound with acetylcholine, this membrane protein, you can see go all the way across the membrane, changes shape from a closed channel, right, because there's only one acetylcholine bound to it. When it binds a second, guess what happens? Changes conformation as channel opens up, and both sodium and potassium can move through. It's mostly sodium moving through because potassium is sort of at its equilibrium potential already. But remember, there's almost hardly any sodium on the inside. Sodium is really high on the outside, negative on the inside. Sodium is positive. So a lot of sodium enters the cell when this channel opens up. So is this an excitatory or inhibitory channel? Excitatory, because we know that when sodium goes in, that causes depolarization. Depolarization is always excitatory, right? Okay, so here is an example of a nicotinic cholinergic receptor. It's just a simple, nice, really simple ion-gated channel. All right, there are other kinds of cholinergic receptors. This is not a nicotinic. This is, what do we call this one? A muscarinic. It still has to bind the neurotransmitter, and it's going to be exactly the same one as before, which is acetylcholine. Right? And does acetylcholine ever enter the cell? No. It's always outside the cell. So this is a part of a, what kind of messenger system? A second messenger system, where the first messenger is outside the cell. Where's the second messenger? Inside the cell. Okay, and here is an example. You're familiar with this. This is a G protein, and it's coupled to a receptor, so we call this a G protein coupled receptor. When acetylcholine binds to the receptor, which goes all the way across the membrane, right, it releases these G proteins that are activated. Some of these subunits dissociate, and they can float around right on the surface or right on the inside of the membrane, move around by diffusion, and they can bump into other membrane proteins. And here is one that it bumps into, and you can see what kind of channel is this. Is this a sodium channel? Glucose channel? No, it is a potassium channel, for example, right? It could be some of these other kinds of channels, but this one is a potassium. And we see when this beta and gamma bump into this one, it opens up the channel. So what does potassium like to do? Go out. And what happens to the membrane potential when that happens? All right, does it become more negative or more positive on the inside when these positive charges leave? More negative. And is that depolarization? No, that is hyperpolarization, right? And is that excitatory or inhibitory? Yeah, when you hyperpolarize, that's inhibition. The membrane potential is driven farther away from threshold, right? So this is an example of an inhibiting neurotransmitter system, right? It doesn't always have to be that way. Sometimes channels close. Right, so if a channel opens, a potassium channel opens, that causes hyperpolarization or inhibits the cell. What happens if there are channels that are normally open and then they're closed by this G protein? What does that cause? That causes depolarization because potassium usually is leaking out through that channel. If you stop that leak, then that's going to depolarize the membrane because that's going to conserve potassium on the inside of the cell. And if you keep all those positives on the inside of the cell and keep them from leaving, that's going to cause depolarization. All right, so here we got a couple lines. Hyperpolarization and depolarization. Make sure you know which one is excitatory, which one is inhibitory. Okay? And if you got a question, make sure you let me know. All right, so we want acetylcholine to go away after it's released from the presynaptic cell. Here's a nice presynaptic cell. We want it to exert its action on the receptor, but we don't want that acetylcholine to be on this receptor forever because then the receptor loses its function. Right? Then you could consider this receptor like poisoned. It can never be reactivated once again. So acetylcholine just moves by diffusion from the receptor into the synaptic cleft, and it can bind to another protein, and these particular proteins are enzymes. And these are called acetylcholinesterase. How do you know these are enzymes? Because that ASC, substrate is the prefix on that word, and the substrate is acetylcholine. Its job is to break acetylcholine down, and it does into acetate and choline. All right, and now, can acetate bind to the receptor? Can choline bind to the receptor? No, because why? You know why. Because they no longer have the right shape, right? And since they don't have the right shape, can't bind to the receptor, these are not neurotransmitters. What is the neurotransmitter here? Only acetylcholine, right? So the shape changes. Now, acetate and choline can be taken up and maybe resynthesized into acetylcholine, or they can be used by other processes inside the cell, like acetate. An acetyl group can be used to make a fatty acid very easily, because fatty acids are made, what, two carbons at a time? Boom, boom, boom. Right? How are fatty acids broken down? Two carbons at a time. And you should know the name of that reaction. And it is called beta oxidation when a fatty acid is broken down. Okay, so acetate is universal. All right, so here is... This would be a muscarinic type cholinergic receptor and how acetylcholine is broken down. Now, signals can only go from the presynaptic cell to the postsynaptic cell. They can't go backwards. We know that action potentials only can go in one direction down an axon, but why do signals go across a synapse in only one direction? You might have to think of that. There are two important reasons why that I see on this graph. And one question would be, which neuron actually releases the signal? Is it the presynaptic or postsynaptic cell? Only the presynaptic neuron has neurotransmitter. The postsynaptic cell doesn't. So the postsynaptic cell can't signal another cell next to it because it doesn't have a neurotransmitter. All right, another reason is, okay, can the presynaptic cell sense, can it receive acetylcholine as a signal? No, because why? It doesn't have any receptors. What cell has receptors? The postsynaptic cell. So signals only go in one direction across the synapse because only the presynaptic cell has neurotransmitter and only the postsynaptic cell has receptor for it. All right, so that actually keeps things nice and simple. All right, let's talk about some more about neurotransmitters. We talked about cholinergic neurons and receptors. So what do cholinergic neurons secrete as a neurotransmitter? By definition, it has to be acetylcholine, right? There is another place, all neuromuscular junctions, all junctions between a motor neuron, a somatic motor neuron, and a skeletal muscle cell, which you have under voluntary control. Those are cholinergic systems. So acetylcholine works as a neurotransmitter. So muscles have nicotinic receptors for acetylcholine. And as a matter of fact, there are so many of those receptors underneath or within that neuromuscular junction that there is always enough EPSP to cause an action potential. All right, so there is almost like no threshold whatsoever, because there's so much acetylcholine released and the muscle cell has so many nicotinic receptors that as soon as a signal reaches the axon terminus of that motor neuron, what happens to that effector? And that effector is going to be a skeletal muscle. When that motor neuron sends a signal down to the axon terminus, what's going to happen to that biceps? It's waiting for an answer. Why is it waiting? Because it's under voluntary control. It's waiting for me to tell it to do something, right? And I'm going to tell it to contract. And what's it going to do? Can it make up its own mind? No, it's just going to contract, right? So skeletal muscle, all right, just is voluntary because these neuromuscular junctions are so big that any kind of neurotransmitter released always causes an action potential to ensue. And that causes the muscle to contract. Okay, and there's something different about a muscle compared to a neuron. Where do we find voltage-gated channels on a neuron? Are there any on dendrites? No. Are there any on cell body? No. Okay, only on the axon, right? So receptors on a neuron are far away from the voltage-gated channels, right? And so what has to happen between a receptor and the voltage-gated channel in order for an action potential to start on an axon? There has to be a graded potential that's high enough in amplitude so that by the time it reaches that axon hillock, it's at threshold voltage. Okay. On a muscle cell, it's a little bit different. There are voltage-gated channels even within the neuromuscular junction. So those graded potentials don't have to travel anywhere. So any kind of excitation from a somatic motor neuron is going to cause an action potential to flow over a muscle, and that muscle is going to contract as a result of it. Muscle can't make up its own mind. A neuron can make up its own mind because it has a threshold voltage, right? So it can make a decision on what to do. Okay, your book calls. I'm going to go back to this slide right here. All right, so we say when acetylcholine, let's go back to this one. Acetylcholine binds to this nicotinic receptor. We see a lot of sodium entering a cell, and that causes depolarization, excitation. That causes that graded potential to start moving over a dendrite or a cell body. Right, and then that graded potential slowly dies away because it travels with decrement. I forgot what I was going to say. Okay. I know what I was going to say. Your book sometimes calls those graded potentials, right, caused by these receptors when they're bound to their ligand. Sometimes they call them synaptic potentials. So maybe in some of the study questions you read synaptic potential. So synaptic potential is exactly the same thing as a graded potential, and we're going to talk about those pretty much exclusively today. As opposed, what's the other kind of potential you're aware of? There are graded potentials and action potentials. That's right. Right. So you should be able to compare and contrast those. These channels right here make graded potentials, and if they're at sufficient amplitude by the time they get to those voltage-gated channels, then they'll cause an action potential to start. Okay. Chirari is a compound that blocks acetylcholine action within the neuromuscular junction. Let's just say that it blocks the binding of acetylcholine to its receptor. So if acetylcholine can't bind to the receptor, then no graded potential will start. And if no graded potential starts, then that muscle can't contract. So that's a particularly good poison for poisoning somatic motor pathways. Curare is made naturally. It occurs naturally. And there were some peoples in the world that were aware of that, and they were able to collect it and use it as an aid in hunting. Because what would happen when you would poison like a game animal with curare? What are you poisoning? Skeletal muscle, right? So certainly they couldn't run away, but they couldn't breathe either, right? So that's really handy. You don't even have to run after your prey as a result of that. So receptor theory is really important. So we need to talk about some other neurotransmitters, like monoamine neurotransmitters. Here are some examples. I'm sure you've heard of all of these, actually. Serotonin is one. Norepinephrine and dopamine is one. Serotonin, in particular, is derived from tryptophan. Who knows something about tryptophan? Tryptophan is an amino acid. It is. Look at here. Norepinephrine and dopamine are neurotransmitters, right? They're important in synaptic transmission. Norepinephrine and dopamine are derived from tyrosine. What do you know about tyrosine? It is an amino acid. Now, it's not just any kind of regular amino acid, but these are what we call essential amino acids, which means what, if they're essential? It means your body can't make them. They have to be in your diet, right? So you actually have to consume these in your diet, and we know that animal products contain many of these amino acids at the right level, right? But plant sources usually have difficulty supplying these amino acids completely to your diet. So if you're vegetarian, you've got to pay a little bit close attention to that. Because if you don't have tryptophan or tyrosine in your diet, what can your body not make? What are you going to be deficient? Serotonin, norepinephrine, dopamine. Okay, and these are important neurotransmitters. So you'll probably lose brain function as a result. And One of our understandings of different kinds of affective disorders like depression, right, are due to a diminished activity of some of these neurotransmitters. So even, so it can greatly affect your mental outlook and the ability of your brain to function. So you need to have a proper diet. Okay, so let's look at synaptic transmission for a monoamine neurotransmitter. And could you give me an example of a monoamine neurotransmitter? Norepinephrine would be one, serotonin, others. So here we have the top cell. What are we going to call the top cell? Presynaptic. The bottom cell is the postsynaptic. The postsynaptic cell has what in its membrane? Receptors. And the presynaptic cell has synaptic vesicles with neurotransmitter in it. So here is tyrosine converted to DOPA, converted to dopamine, and then finally norepinephrine. So you see these are all related compounds. Norepinephrine is stored in the synaptic vesicle until an action potential comes down the axon, and that opens calcium channels, voltage-gated calcium channels, which then move these vesicles over to the presynaptic membrane, pretty much like what we've seen before. Now, norepinephrine is released into the synaptic cleft. And how does norepinephrine diffuse? How does anything diffuse? From high concentration to low concentration. Did you see the cursor? High concentration to low. So that neurotransmitter moves over to the postsynaptic membrane. And you'd already told me that this postsynaptic membrane has receptors. And what kind of receptor does this look like? I don't know if you can see it large enough. It looks like, is it just an ion channel that opens up? No, see this little leg right here? So this is a G-coupled protein. All right, so monoamine neurotransmitters work through G-coupled proteins. Okay. Well, we said that neurotransmitter should be broken down, right? Should be taken away from the synaptic cleft so that these receptors can be reset and then another signal can be sent. So there's a little bit of difference. Notice there are no enzymes in the postsynaptic membrane like we saw for acetylcholine. Instead, these neurotransmitters are taken back up into the presynaptic cell. They leave the synaptic cleft by reuptake. And then they're broken down inside the cell or used to just be recycled into that neurotransmitter. So they're no longer broken down like acetylcholine is. All right, so reuptake of neurotransmitter is the way to reduce the action or terminate the action of this neurotransmitter. Now, once this neurotransmitter is back in the cell, there is an enzyme called monoamine oxidase, which can break the neurotransmitter down to its building blocks once again, and those building blocks can be used for different effects. So we know that in some pathologies, for instance, clinical depression, right? There are people that don't have enough norepinephrine working for them. And so one way to increase the amount of norepinephrine in these neurons is to prevent its breakdown. Right? And so sometimes monoamine oxidase inhibitors, where do we have that? Well, if you inhibit monoamine oxidase, right, then you're going to have more norepinephrine inside the cell to be used as a neurotransmitter. So that's really a particularly good therapy. Okay, you don't have to know any names of monoamine oxidase inhibitors, but you should at least know something about reuptake, terminating the action of norepinephrine. How could we potentiate or accentuate the action of norepinephrine is block its breakdown once it goes into the cell. Okay, by monoamine oxidase inhibitors. All right, so what kind of, is this a cholinergic pathway? One that uses norepinephrine. Is this a cholinergic neuron? No. It is what we say an adrenergic neuron, right? Because it doesn't use acetylcholine, it uses norepinephrine. Okay. All right, so let's look in some detail in this G protein coupled receptor, and we see that on this particular slide. Nice phospholipid bilayer. And here is the receptor protein, goes across the membrane, here's the G protein, and it just has to bind one norepinephrine molecule. So how many norepinephrine molecules are being used in this system to signal something that's going to change inside the cell? There's only one, okay? And what kind of messenger is it? It's a first messenger because it's outside the cell. All right, well, how does the signal get inside the cell? When it binds, when this ligand binds to the receptor, it releases the G protein. G protein dissociates. Alpha subunit diffuses around within the membrane, bumps into a membrane protein. This one here happens to be adenylate cyclase. Tell me just a little bit about adenylate cyclase. I think we talked about it. Certainly we talked about the general class of these kinds of compounds. Cyclase is an enzyme, because you see that ASE on the end. Adenylate cyclase in particular will take an ATP and convert it into adenosine monophosphate, or AMP, but a special form of AMP which has a little ring structure to it, so we call that cyclic AMP. So cyclic AMP then becomes a second messenger inside the cell, never leaves the cell, and it can then change the activity of other enzymes, like a protein kinase. It can take an inactive protein kinase, so maybe cyclic AMP binds to another site on that protein kinase. And what does a protein kinase do? It runs around phosphorylating things, different kinds of proteins within inside the cell. It's going to change their shape, which means it's going to change their function, right? And that protein kinase will phosphorylate this protein right here. It's going to change its shape, and it's going to change the function of this particular protein, and you can see that it's really an ion channel. So if this thing becomes phosphorylated, then this channel opens, and sodium can enter the cell, and that's going to cause depolarization or excitation. That would be one example. Okay, so what I see right here are a number of steps. And you might be saying, wow, why are there so many steps? Why do I have to know about all these steps? And why on earth are they there? Just to make it complicated? Well, let's take a look at a reason. All right, so what can you tell me about adenylate cyclase once again? It's an enzyme. All right, what can you tell me about an enzyme before the reaction and after the reaction? Exactly the same. So once this adenylate cyclase becomes activated by this alpha subunit, right, it just doesn't convert one ATP into cyclic AMP. It converts many, right? It can maybe even thousands. So what do we call this? One signal molecule on the outside, thousands on the inside. That's a level of amplification that's making the signal a lot bigger, 1,000 times bigger. Right? And then the cyclic AMP can activate another enzyme, right? And that's an enzyme. And what about this enzyme? Once it becomes activated and phosphorylates something, does it get used up? No. It can phosphorylate even more things, maybe 1,000 more molecules. So the first step right here, you had an amplification of 1,000 times. Over here, another amplification of 1,000 times. So now you multiply those two together to get an understanding of what kind of signal is being produced in the cell. So now you got thousands and thousands and thousands of these phosphorylated proteins in the cell, all the result of how many signal compounds? Just one. So these two levels of amplification are what we call a cascade mechanism. So a cascade mechanism is something that allows all this biochemistry inside the cell to happen rapidly. It causes rapid changes in many, many different kinds of molecules at the same time as a result of just one ligand binding to a receptor. Okay, so it can have an effect inside the cell very rapidly, even though it's going to take all these different steps to do that. Okay, so that's a cascade because you see a number of steps, and in each one of those steps you have a level of amplification. All right, let's talk about another neurotransmitter, serotonin. It's involved with regulation, mood, behavior, appetite, even cerebral circulation, right? You can't have cerebral function, right? You certainly won't be thinking properly without circulation in the parts of the brain that need oxygen, for instance. And the action of serotonin at the synapse is broken down, okay, the same way that epinephrine is, and that is by reuptake. So serotonin, the effect of serotonin in these neurons can be accentuated by giving reuptake inhibitors so that serotonin will stay longer in the synaptic cleft. These can be used as antidepressants as well. So we see that both serotonin and norepinephrine are involved with that clinical disorder that we call clinical depression. All right, so these drugs right here, Prozac, Zoloft, Paxil, Luvox, block the reuptake of serotonin. So if it blocks the uptake of serotonin, or if these compounds block the reuptake of serotonin, where does serotonin stay? In the synaptic cleft. And if it's in the synaptic cleft, it can bind to receptor once again, right? Even though it was only released from the presynaptic neuron one time. It can bind to a receptor, right, and bind to another one and bind to another one. So it acts like there's more serotonin being released from the presynaptic cell. Dopamine is another important neurotransmitter. There's probably more than two major dopaminergic systems in our brain, but here are two of them. One is the nigrostriatal dopaminergic system, and that originates in the substantia nigra. That's involved in motor control. So what do we mean by motor control? As a matter of fact, maybe you want to write down somatic motor control. What's somatic motor in your body? Yeah, skeletal muscle in particular. Not smooth muscle, not cardiac muscle, but skeletal muscle. And what do those skeletal muscles control? What do they move? Yeah, I would say, yeah, they move your skeleton, right? Because that's why we call those skeletal muscles. All right, so this system is really important in your motion, controlling motion inside your body. And there is damage to this system in Parkinson's disease. And you know somebody with Parkinson's disease, they're very rigid all the time. They might have tremor. They have difficulty moving because it's involved with their, what, somatic muscles, skeletal muscles. And Parkinson's disease, you know any famous people that have Parkinson's disease? Maybe if we say a name, you'll have an idea in your mind of what it's like. Michael J. Fox, I heard. Muhammad Ali, I heard, at the same time. Yes, both of these people. Okay, so how did Muhammad Ali get Parkinson's disease at an early age? Probably trauma to his head, right? Because he was a boxer. That trauma to his head damaged the system, right? And when you speak with Muhammad Ali today, right, what kind of impression do you get? If you didn't know he had Parkinson's disease, you'd see him kind of stumbling and walking, kind of slurring his speech because he doesn't have nice motor control of his orbicularis oris muscle. What would be your impression?
That he would be? That would he be, like he looks like he's intoxicated, right? Looks like if he's intoxicated on alcohol, kind of looks drunk, for instance. All right, but is he drunk? No, he's not using alcohol inappropriately at inappropriate times. He just has this disease that we call Parkinson's disease. Right? So if you run into people like that clinically, they might appear drunk. Don't automatically treat them like a substance abuser because they might have a real organic reason why they can't move their body properly. Right? So, and of course, you always got to be concerned about substance abusers because you don't really know what they're going to do if they don't get drugs. So you do have to protect yourself. But you have to protect yourself from somebody that has Parkinson's disease. No, you don't, right? Just totally different kinds of things. Okay, another dopaminergic system is this mesolimbic dopaminergic system. It's involved with behavior, emotional reward, and this is the system that gets accentuated, right, or stimulated by different kinds of drugs, okay, like opiates, for instance. So when people take these drugs, they have emotional reward that produces a psychological addiction due to this system right here. All right, so you see that some of these drugs can be used by addicts for emotional reward, which is a positive stimulus for them, all right, but when they take not serotonin necessarily, but things that can bind to serotonin receptors, where else can those drugs bind? To these pathways that are involved with motor control. And I'm going to ask you a question in just a second. There was one case, and maybe there was more than one, where there were some addicts in England, and they got a hold of some synthetic opiates. And the opiates weren't built properly. They had a different kind of structure. They bound to the serotonergic receptors in their brain, but then they never let go.
both in the mesolimbic system and the nigrostriatal system. And as a result of that, that poisoned all of these receptors, and what did they get? They got Parkinson's disease immediately, and a severe case to where they lost control of every skeletal muscle in their body, which is terrible. And it happened, and guess what? No one has ever figured out a way how to reverse that effect, so they basically poisoned their skeletal muscles for the rest of their life. You can maybe look that up on the internet. 60 Minutes did a nice study, frozen addicts as a result of poisoning their nigrostriatal system. How do they breathe? They're either on a respirator, okay, or maybe they have partial control, okay? And since they're not moving, they certainly don't need to hyperventilate, right? Yeah. Yeah, question?
After someone eats and they feel better, is that part of, like, emotional reward?
Yeah, I don't know the pathway that's involved. It could be dopamine, could be serotonin as well. Yeah. Yeah, that would be interesting. That would be a nice paper to write. Probably somebody's written it already. But that would be nice. Okay, what else did I want to say? Oh, somebody mentioned Michael J. Fox. Okay, Parkinson's disease. Very early onset. Usually this happens to people later in their life. It happened to him very early on. And he said that he never abused any drugs whatsoever. And I probably believe him. He's a good Canadian boy. When that happened, he wouldn't abuse drugs, right? But he was involved with a show called, Family Ties, as a very young actor. And one thing that was done in Hollywood, maybe even today still, is that they're given amphetamines and other kinds of stimulants so that when it's time to shoot, these old actors are ready to go and they're very active during that period of time when they're filming. And somebody has surmised that some synthetic amphetamines were given to the actors on that show, particularly the young ones, which then bound to these dopaminergic receptors that produce that early onset of Parkinson's disease. And one other line of evidence for that is that he's not the only child that came down with early onset disease from that particular show. So it seems like it was more broad-based. Is there another question up there? No. Okay. All right, so these are some of the fascinating things why we want to be concerned with receptors, because we use them also to help patients. In schizophrenia, we think that it contributes to schizophrenia because the dopaminergic pathways are overactive as opposed to Parkinson's disease where they're underactive. So if that's the case, then if we give them anti-dopaminergic drugs, that will help them. Okay, with schizophrenia, and indeed, some of these drugs are like miracle drugs. They just kind of work overnight. Okay. Norepinephrine, we talked about that a little bit. It's used both in the peripheral nervous system and central nervous system. You probably ran into it peripherally in terms of the autonomic nervous system. If you haven't, we'll look at that really soon in a couple of weeks. And so, in particular, where you find it in the autonomic nervous system is the sympathetic division. And so, sometimes we think of norepinephrine as the fight or flight neurotransmitter. So, we'll see what the effect is all over your body, not today. CNS effects generally increase your level of arousal or awakeness, right? And amphetamines stimulate these particular norepinephrine pathways. So what can you tell me about the shape of amphetamines and the shape of norepinephrine? Somewhere they've got to be very similar so that they can bind to the receptor, right? Okay. There are a number of amino acid neurotransmitters. Here are some. Recognize glutamic, aspartic acid as amino acids. Glycine is one of them as well. Gamma-aminobutyric acid, we just call that GABA, you can call that GABA. That's an amino acid as well. Some of these are excitatory neurotransmitters, some are inhibitory. If it's an excitatory neurotransmitter, when they bind to a receptor, what do they produce if they're excitatory? Depolarization. If they're an inhibitory neurotransmitter, what do they produce when they bind to a receptor? Hyperpolarization, right? The other way. Okay, so glutamic acid, aspartic acid are major central nervous system excitatory neurotransmitters. All right, but I'm going to use my biceps and my triceps. I'm going to use my biceps and then my triceps. So what would you expect in the brain if you want precise control and balance inside your brain? Biceps, triceps, biceps. Antagonism. Yeah, so if we have excitatory neurotransmitters, what would you automatically expect? Inhibitory neurotransmitters. And as a matter of fact, we probably have more inhibitory neurotransmitters in our brain and spinal cord than we do excitatory. One example would be glycine. Glycine is a very important inhibitory neurotransmitter. It opens up chlorine channels, which hyperpolarize. So chlorine is extracellular, high concentration. When that channel opens up, chlorine enters the cell. You see that chlorine is an anion. So what happens to the membrane potential when chlorine enters? It hyperpolarizes, right? The inside of the cell becomes more negative because chloride is an anion. And so that inhibits many pathways in the body. Strychnine is a particularly good poison because it blocks these receptors. It blocks these inhibitory receptors. And one of the effects of blocking these inhibitory pathways is that then only the excitatory ones are operating. There's no way to brake, right? It's like gas pedal all the time. There's no brake pedal. So when somebody is poisoned with strychnine, if they're not doing anything, don't hear anything, right, they can stay relaxed. But as soon as they're presented with a stimulus, maybe a loud noise or somebody pokes them in the shoulder, guess what happens to them? They go into contracture, right? And usually the stomach muscles are stronger than your back muscles, and these people just die all crumpled up because those skeletal muscles never relax. The inhibitory pathways are taken away from them. So inhibitory pathways are very important, right? So just don't rely on excitatory pathways in your appreciation on how your body works. GABA is the most common neurotransmitter in the brain, and it's inhibitory as well. It opens up chloride channels, just like glycine. These particular receptors degenerate in Huntington's disease, right? And Huntington's disease, I guess sort of like Parkinson's, gives you kind of a very rigid frame. It's hard to relax muscles, so it's hard to move because in order for my biceps to contract, what does my triceps have to do? It's got to relax. And if the triceps can't relax, when the biceps contracts, where's my arm going to go? It's not going to go anywhere. Right, if they're both contracting, my arm can't go anywhere. Got to relax that triceps, right? So that's one of the observations during Huntington's disease. Okay, so synaptic integration. How many synapses? How many kinds of synapses? The major categories. How many major kinds of categories of synapses did we look at so far?
Two.
What were the two?
Yeah, pre and post. Synaptic neurons, I like that, so that's two. That lines up with two really well. But in terms of a synapse, two major kinds of categories.
We just got done looking at chemical synapses because they rely on a neurotransmitter, a chemical to go from the presynaptic cell to the postsynaptic cell. What else besides a chemical synapse is there?
An electrical synapse. Yeah, so don't forget about those electrical. You got two kinds, chemical and electrical. And those electrical are just due to those gap junctions at a low sodium to move from one cell to the next. And when sodium moves into the cell, what happens to that cell? It depolarizes, right, which is an excitatory signal.
Okay, well, let's wrap all of these ideas up. I think we talked about EPSPs and IPSPs previously, and an EPSP, anybody remember what there it is. It's an excitatory, right? Excitatory postsynaptic potential. So this works on what? The postsynaptic neuron when it binds a ligand, and it changes the voltage, right? If it opens, for instance, maybe a sodium channel that causes depolarization, that would be an EPSP, and that produces a graded potential. It's going to move away from that site of a receptor, and it's going to slowly die away. But remember, graded potentials can also summate. Action potentials can't, but graded potentials can. And an EPSP is a graded potential. And remember, your book sometimes call a graded potential a synaptic potential, synaptic and graded.
synaptic sort of means more like the location. Graded has more to do with the electrophysiology. People use those terms interchangeably, though. Okay, so something that can open up a sodium channel, if it's a ligand-gated channel, produces a graded potential. So their EPSPs are graded in magnitude or amplitude. And unlike an action potential, they don't have a threshold. As soon as you open up a sodium channel, that produces a change in the voltage of the membrane. So there is no threshold for a graded potential or a synaptic potential. An EPSP always causes depolarization, right? And because they're a graded potential, they can summate, they can add together. Another thing that's different is compared to an action potential is that there's no refractory period, right? So they can happen almost simultaneously. So let's take a look at this graph right here. We got a graph of voltage, and this is a voltage across the membrane. So this is membrane potential versus time. And we're going to stimulate this, so here, and it's superimposed on this neuron. So I got dendrites and cell body. What's the general function of a cell body and dendrite, which is different than an axon at the receiving end, because it has ligand-gated channels. Ligand-gated channels can produce graded potentials. For an example, an EPSP. And of course, the axon is ascending part of the neuron because why? Yeah, it doesn't have ligand-gated channels. Now it has voltage-gated channels. Okay. All right, so let's stay over here on dendrites and cell bodies. We see that one graded potential, okay, can follow another one. There's no refractory period. And what can you tell me about the amplitude of 1, 2, 3 graded potentials? Are they the same like an action potential? They're different. And what are they directly related to? The stimulus. As the stimulus intensity increases, then the graded, see the length of these arrows right here, then the graded potential also increases in magnitude. All right, and if it is at threshold voltage by the time it reaches the axon hillock, then of course you know there is an action potential that started. All right, so what can you tell me about an action potential here at the axon hillock compared to one that's like a mile away on this axon? Exactly the same. All right, what can you tell me about a graded or synaptic potential if it was here, right, and then it travels over to the other side of the cell body? What happens to it? It dies away, right? It starts to decrease in magnitude. So these are, I see EPSPs because they are causing depolarization in each of these particular cases. All right, so I promised you I'd show you some summation. Here is a neuron. Here's a postsynaptic neuron. And how many presynaptic neurons do you see on this illustration? I see 2. All right, so I see 2 presynaptic neurons. And these are going to release an excitatory neurotransmitter, let's just say acetylcholine. So these are cholinergic neurons. And if neuron number 1 releases acetylcholine on this dendrite, but not number 2, right, it's going to cause a graded potential or synaptic potential, which is going to flow over the dendrite into the axon hillock. And let's just say this is what we see. Right, it causes depolarization, so that's an EPSP, but is it a threshold? No, it's not a threshold. So by the time it reaches the axon hillock, will an action potential be triggered at this point in time? Okay, if it is sub-threshold, it won't start an action potential because no voltage-gated channels are going to be opening up. Okay, that's if only the top neuron releases neurotransmitter. All right, what if both of these neurons release excitatory neurotransmitter almost at exactly the same time, almost the same time. So here is the release from neuron number 1, like we saw over here. But here is some neurotransmitter released from neuron number 2. And now what can you tell me about EPSP number 1 and EPSP number 2 from neuron number 2? They're adding together. You never see that with action potentials, but you do with synaptic potentials or graded potentials. And in this particular case now, when we add these two EPSPs together, is it subthreshold or threshold?
Threshold?
It's a threshold. So now this postsynaptic cell has added information together from both of these neurons. What do we call that when we add information together? Summation, or, and I was thinking, yeah, summation I like a lot. I was thinking of integration. Okay, so this postsynaptic neuron is actually integrating information up from different parts of your body to decide whether or not to trigger an action potential. So every neuron in your body acts as an integrator. It looks at information, right, and decides whether or not it should be passed on down the line. So that's pretty powerful processing. All right, well, we got a couple different kinds of summation. We have temporal summation that occurs because EPSPs occur closely in time, and they sum to threshold before they fade away. So this sort of looks like temporal summation, right? The one from neuron number one came at a little bit different time, but it's still, there's a little residual from EPSP 2, so it still reached threshold. So if they're close enough in time, they can summate. That's temporal summation. Right? But another way is spatial summation. Right? For instance, if graded potentials are coming from two different locations, like these two different dendrites, even at the same time, and if either one is subthreshold, they can still add together. Right? So for spatial summation, you need two neurons. For temporal summation, there could even be one neuron that is releasing like two bursts of acetylcholine very close together. And those graded potentials can summate. Okay. All right, so
that's something about EPSPs. What's another kind of SP or PSP? Yeah, we got EPSPs and IPSPs. What do IPSPs do? They inhibit by causing hyperpolarization,
right, by maybe opening up a potassium channel or opening up a chloride channel. They're going to cause hyperpolarization. Right? And so hyperpolarization is what, excitatory or inhibitory? And that's the title of these slides. We're going to look at some synaptic inhibition. So when you see synaptic inhibition, you should think automatically of hyperpolarization. Right? Hyperpolarization. All right, and there's two kinds that we're going to look at, postsynaptic and presynaptic. And this slide right here shows postsynaptic. We're going to look at that first. All right, so we said that GABA and glycine are important inhibitory neurotransmitters on one of those previous slides, which mean that they hyperpolarize the postsynaptic membrane. And when this postsynaptic membrane is inhibited, it's hyperpolarized, because GABA and glycine produce IPSPs instead of EPSPs. It causes hyperpolarization. Okay, so let's look. Here we have a graph, again, of membrane potential versus time, for instance. And the top cell over here is going to release neurotransmitter like GABA and glycine. What kind of neurotransmitters are these once again? Are they excitatory or inhibitory? Inhibitory. They produce an IPSP. All right, so they go across the synapse, bind to the postsynaptic cell, and it produces a hyperpolarization. This hyperpolarization of the cell membrane is what we call an IPSP. Can be produced by GABA and glycine because these are inhibitory neurotransmitters. All right, so after that inhibitory neurotransmitter takes an effect, we see now how much of a stimulus is necessary to reach threshold. Is it the same amount after inhibition or the same amount as before inhibition? And requires a greater stimulus after inhibition because of that hyperpolarization. All right, so if the second neuron then releases excitatory neurotransmitter after the postsynaptic cell is inhibited, right, it is a, what kind of stimulus is this EPSP? Even though it's excitatory, it's causing depolarization, but what kind of depolarization is that? That is a sub-threshold depolarization, right, because it doesn't reach threshold right here. But if this IPSP didn't precede it, guess what? This would have been a threshold stimulus. All right, so this shows how activity of the postsynaptic neuron, right, or the integration effect of on the postsynaptic neuron. It's adding the effects of both one and two together. And in this particular case, these stimuli counteract each other. They don't produce an action potential on these dendrites where I see these, where the synapses are. All right, so that's postsynaptic inhibition because what cell are we watching these iPSPs and EPSPs on? Postsynaptic inhibition because we're observing these postsynaptic potentials, well, it's in the word, on the postsynaptic cell. So that's why we call this postsynaptic inhibition because it's inhibiting the postsynaptic cell. All right. One other thing we're going to talk about is presynaptic inhibition. So what neuron do we want to talk about? The one that comes before the synapse, right? All right, so this occurs when one neuron synapses onto an axon or maybe the Bouton terminale of another one, inhibiting the release. So before, so it's on the presynaptic neuron, before the neurotransmitter is even released, before it can even get to the postsynaptic neuron. All right, so how can that happen? Here's a nice illustration. We're not so familiar with these kinds of synapses as we are, just a typical kind of synapse that we have been looking at. But what do we have on this slide? Okay, I see, here's a neuron, and it looks like it's in gold. Is that a nice gold neuron, yellow, something like that? Okay, and just for fun, what kind of neuron is this? By shape, is it bipolar, pseudo-unipolar, multipolar, right? And you should know the function of multipolar cells. They're somatic motor neurons, right, or their interneurons or association neurons inside the central nervous system. So this could be in the central nervous system someplace. And of course we see the dendrites. And then I would guess this is red. Could be green, but it's probably red. Is this red?
Brown.
Wow, neither. Okay, brown. So these brown things right here are axons coming from other cells, right? And the other cells are what, before the synapse or after the synapse? Before, so these are all presynaptic cells, right? These are all presynaptic cells. The gold one is the postsynaptic. Here I see a nice Bouton from a presynaptic cell. Here another one from a presynaptic cell. These that synapse on the body of a neuron. Ooh, what's another name for body of a neuron? A soma. Yeah. All right. So these kind of synapses on the body of a neuron are what we call axosomatic synapses because you have an axon here and here's the soma of the neuron. Axosomatic. What else do we have? We have some axon termini terminating on a dendrite. I see one here. I see one here. Okay. Probably right here is another one. So what would we want to call these on a dendrite? Would we want to call these an axosomatic? Probably not. We would want to call these an axodendritic kind of synapse, right? So that's the second kind, axodendritic. So far this isn't so bad because what did we understand? What's the function of the cell body and dendrites? Is that the receiving end or sending end? That's the receiving end, right? So I'd expect to have synapses on dendrites and cell bodies, right? That's not so unusual. Axosomatic, axodendritic synapses. But we got a third kind of beast. Look at this one right here. Ah. No, that's an axodendritic. Let's look at this one right here. It goes from an axon of one neuron to the axon of another neuron. So this one right here is what we call an axoaxonic synapse. Axoaxonic. And this one right here, so usually you only think of a synapse, right, between these two cells, the pre and post. All right, but here we see a synapse actually between two presynaptic cells on the postsynaptic cell. If this, too bad these aren't different colors. If this top neuron right here is releasing inhibitory neurotransmitter and the bottom axon has receptors for that inhibitory neurotransmitter, that can produce a iPSP of sufficient magnitude to block the transmission of the action potential over this location on an axon. So it can block the arrival of an action potential at the axon terminus of that excitatory neuron. And if the excitatory neuron doesn't receive action potentials, what's going to be inhibited? The release of excitatory neurotransmitter on the postsynaptic cell. All right, so that is what we call presynaptic inhibition because this is happening on the presynaptic cell, not the postsynaptic cell. All right, so what is the only way you can inhibit a cell? by hyperpolarizing the membrane. Right? Hyperpolarizing the membrane. And that is done with these inhibitory neurotransmitters. And then even at a really nice chemical basic level, when you cause hyperpolarization, what's happening? What kind of channels are opening? It could, number one, could be a potassium. So a positive potassium leaves the cell, which makes the cell inside more negative, right? Or maybe it's opening a chloride channel. Chloride, remember, is an anion. It's negative, and when that negative charge enters the cell, then that hyperpolarizes the membrane, right? It becomes more negative as well. Okay. Well, so this is just some of the building blocks. It might seem a little hard to understand because we're not relating it directly to some part of your body, but that's kind of the job of the rest of the class, right? Is to let you see where these G protein coupled receptors are operating and just the nicotinic receptors and where we have iPSPs and EPSPs to control your physiology. So these are building blocks for understanding how physiology is controlled. Okay. So any questions? I bet we're going to have time to look at find your figure. Any questions over this stuff? All right, this is why it's important to become a little familiar with the material before lecture, because this is probably pretty weird compared to what you learned in biology class and anatomy class. Yeah. I don't see any questions. So let's try to find your slide. So let's go back. Where was your slide at? You said it was a big gold one? Big yellow one? This one? No.
Yeah.
Okay. What on this slide would you like to know? Okay. Do you have the number of this slide in your notes at all? If you don't, that's okay. I would just like to say it on the recorder. Because we're flipping way back to somewhere in the middle of the lecture that we had. Oh, it says? That's just not the slide number? 749 is the picture number too?
Yeah, the page number.
That's the page number. Okay. What's this next one? 50? Oh, 4950? I don't know. Looks like slide number to me. Okay. But maybe it could be slide and page number together. Okay. What kind of question do you have on this general illustration of a chemical synapse? Not electrical, but a chemical synapse. Presynaptic cell, postsynaptic cell. Which one releases neurotransmitter? Presynaptic cell. Which one has receptor? Ah, not shown on this diagram. Ah, draw it in. Postsynaptic cell. Okay. What is the chemical signal that signals these synaptic vesicles to move over to the cell membrane? An increase in calcium within this terminal button. Because remember, inside the cell, calcium should be low, almost zero. But when these calcium channels open up, calcium is high outside the cell. It rushes in. And that's the signal that starts a bunch of mechanisms to move these synaptic vesicles to the presynaptic membrane. Yeah. And as that information goes from the presynaptic to the postsynaptic cell, let's go over that. What form is the information in as it's going over the cell membrane of the presynaptic cell? It's electrical. Yeah, it's an electrical signal. And as it moves across the synapse, what kind of signal is it? It's a chemical signal. And then when it gets started in the postsynaptic cell, what kind of signal is it in the postsynaptic cell? It is electrical once again, right? So a chemical synapse, information is transmitted first as an electrical signal, converted into a chemical, which gets converted into an electrical signal. In an electrical synapse, there's no chemicals involved, right? No neurotransmitters. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, pretty much. Because that's where it's useful. So the cell is pretty amazing. It knows where to put all these little proteins. Right? If it's an epithelium, it knows to put it only in the apical surface of that cell. Different proteins in the basal surface. And since those proteins all have different shapes, then those surfaces all have different functions. Yeah. But can you remember your question? Calmodulin.
Yeah.
I like calmodulin. Sensor protein?
Couldn't it be the same sensor
Yeah, I guess I would go with that. That's a good because it senses the presence of calcium. And when calcium is there, it receives that signal and becomes activated. Yeah, so I would like that to be the sensor protein. And it's what is it sensing? What does calmodulin sense? Yeah, calcium concentration inside the axon terminus. Oh, question, another question? Oh, it binds calcium, and then it becomes activated. So activated calmodulin has calcium bound to it, and then calmodulin can activate other enzymes inside the system. So that is what we saw to be a cascade mechanism. Calcium binds to calmodulin. Yeah, calcium doesn't bind to the enzymes necessarily. And calmodulin modulates the activity of various enzymes inside the cell. And we're going to have to take a look at some of the, actually, you're sort of familiar. Oh, no, it's information on this test. Like the Cori cycle. Okay. How does glucose get trapped inside of a cell? Yeah, with a kinase. And so sometimes these signals can activate that kinase, right? And that's going to trap glucose inside the cell. And that also affects glycogenesis and glycogenolysis, whether those proteins, those enzymes are phosphorylated or not. So it can make glycogenesis happen or glycogenolysis happen inside the cell just by phosphorylating enzymes. Any other questions? So we got what, another half hour in class? 5 minutes? Okay. Well, make sure you sign the sign-in sheet. I think that's all I want to say unless you have some questions. I want to go over the hand-drawn illustration of the nerve cell next time, first off, right before I get into the next chapter. That's in, the sign-in sheet is coming around someplace. So come, bring it on down. Oh, I forgot to mention, you do have extra credit drawing today in lab. I sent that out this morning. But it's just a drawing of an action potential. So you guys should be really up on that. And have enough time to do it in lab.